had fundamental changes in the structure of society, and particularly at the replacement of the authoritarian state by some form of non-governmental cooperation between free individuals.
How does an entire city become paralyzed by an overload of movement? How does nearly every street of Montreal get filled to the brim with people to the point that such energy exhausts police forces? And how does this look to someone who spent his life in the struggles of Quebec? Today we discuss with Richard St-Pierre, a longtime radical and revolutionary in Montreal, Quebec, what it means to lead a lifetime of militancy and how today's struggles stand out to him as something he's never seen before. This is an interview by Scott Napolos and Monica Costas from Miami Autonomy and Solidarity.
So how did you get involved in the movement in general?
I come from a small mining town in northern Ontario called Kirkland Lake, which has the particularity of being named by a lake that does not exist anymore because the mining companies just fill it up with the mine tailings. And has another particularity, it was the only large wartime strike in Canada, where the 8,000 gold miners went on strike in 1942. A strike that was eventually smashed. That strike was led by a descendant of the Western Federation of Miners of the IWW called United Electrical and Smelter Workers of America. Okay. And that strike of 8,000, even though it was eventually smashed by police repression, became a rallying cry for organization of miners all across northern Ontario and Quebec. And until the beginning of the 60s, one of the main rallying cries would be Remember Kirkland Lake. That's where I was born. So I think, you want an anecdote?
Yeah.
Okay, some people ask me how come I've stayed so persistent. And when my father died a couple of years back, my aunties came over. And we had, after the funeral, we had a glass of rye whiskey together, and everybody was telling anecdotes. And I told one of my aunts and my mother, I keep all through my life, I've kept having this recurring dream that my mom's up, seems to be up there, so it's like a giant. I'm in some kind of a box, and at some point, all kinds of stuff fall on my head. And I wake up in a trance, in a sweat. And my auntie Jacqueline said, Richard, that's not a dream. What happened was, when you were 3 years old, the miners would, we'd do our grocery at the Star Store, which was some Italian immigrants that had a small grocery store, because they would give credit to the miners, especially during strikes. And your mother, Marie, she was in the grocery store, and you were in, I don't know how you say that, the carriage where she puts the groceries in, and you were sitting there as a baby. And there was a huge air blast that killed 13 miners, and it made the equivalent of a small earthquake in the city. And she was in the can aisle of the grocery, and the shelves fell, and all the cans fell on you as a baby, and you were badly hurt. They needed to bring me to hospital because I was full of blood everywhere. So I think that I've got the class struggle in me since then.
So at some point you joined those mines and became a worker there, correct?
I started work at the Falcon Ridge copper mine at Lake Dufault, 9 miles to the north of Rouyn-Noranda in northwestern Quebec. The real name of the region is Abitibi, which is an Algonquin name that means watershed. After that, that mine was quite dangerous, and with 240 miners. But I had already started to be a radical worker, and there was an opportunity to go and work at the Noranda mines that was directly in Noranda. And that was 2,250 workers. And for me, that was a better opportunity to get into contact and maybe actually be able to get a fight going on with a larger number of proletarians. And I worked there with other comrades that were pretty much my age until I was repressed by the mine and the United Steelworkers of America on the basis of the anti-communist, anti-KKK clause of the Constitution, because there is one. Okay, and the union refused to defend us. What we had done is we had led the first wildcat strike. That was 75 or 76. I'm not sure of the exact date. Since 1953, because in 1953, the United Steelworkers was in a campaign to raid all the old mine, what we call the mine mill. That's the descendant of that Western Federation of Miners of Big Bill, Haywood, etc. All across northern Quebec and northern Ontario. And they eventually were able to break them, except for the one of the big, huge nickel mines, the old Falcon Ridge in Sudbury, which is still Mine Mill and Smelter Workers of America. I think it's the last local of the United Mine Mill and Smelter Workers of America. That's the union that produced the American film on a Latino strike in the 50s called The Salt of the Earth. This is an international struggle.
You were involved in some wildcats around 1975, 76.
Got squashed there.
For people in the United States, they might not know that there was a general strike in Quebec around the same time.
72. Before 1972, I was already radicalized as a kid, but I had nationalist illusions, and I was influenced by the ideas of the... I can't really say their ideas of the Front de Libération du Québec, the FLQ. And I did some adventurous stuff back then. And then there was the 1972 general strike, where especially in the mining regions, like the North Shore, the workers took over the North Shore. They kicked out the police, they occupied the radio stations, they put out workers' news. We did it on a slightly smaller basis in northern Quebec, but the miners did come out on strike, wildcat strike, to support the teachers. Okay, and when we pulsed the provincial police from our town, about 7 miles out of our town, on the other side of a bridge to the south for a couple of days, and that pretty much shook me in terms of. What's better, bombs or the working class? And so I had this process, but I was something of a punk back then, eh? Not 2 or 3 years ago, an old woman militant told me that when we first met, the report that they got in Montreal was, we met this gang of young working class bums. And she says, you were our bums, but we didn't know that. But we were a bit treated like bums, amicably. And so after that, one of the leaders of the ex-FLQ, whose name is Charles Gagnon, died a few years back, came to Noranda and said, you know, Richard, these bomb things, we did them in the 60s, didn't lead us anywhere except getting us killed or getting us in jail. What we need is to build a mass working class organization and political organization too. So because it was coming from a man that had been in jail for 4 years and had gone back to jail again, I didn't think he was a coward, and I listened. And so I joined at that time a Marxist-Leninist, not a really a Chinese-lined ML group, but a pro-China, generally pro-China, what we would call an anti-revisionist group called En Lutte, which is In Struggle. And while I was already in that group, by the time I was not in that group at the Falcon Ridge mine, but at the Noranda mines, I was in that group. And after I was fired, I went up to Ungava Bay, which more precisely Deception Bay, which is the absolute extremity of Quebec, in the Arctic Circle, where there was an asbestos mine called Asbestos Corporation, and I tried to unionize that one, and then and they cut me, and then I couldn't work there anymore. And then when I came back to my Rouyn Noranda, which had become by then my hometown, because we moved from Kirkland Lake to Noranda, which is 54 miles from Ontario to Quebec. There's no frontier. We don't want any either. And so by then I was living in Rouyn Noranda. I was pretty much blacklisted. I needed a job. I was in a bar. It's a small town of about 30,000 people. And a pro-Chinese guy, but from the official pro-Chinese guy, a professor came to see me and he says, we've got this small daycare center we're trying to push up. This is end of 1977, at the local Cégep college, professional and general college. And we need a man there. We think it's important to have a male presence with the children too. And I didn't want to work there, but I ended up accepting, and I stayed in a daycare movement, because that's what it was. It was not an institution yet. A movement for 7 years in which we participated actively in the organization. I was on the provincial Bureau Provincial, and a provincial bureau of the daycare movement, where I was, again, the only guy. And in that whole period, we organized what was called the Regroupement des Garderies, like the daycare's union. But that included the parents and the workers, and up to a certain point, the children too. And we occupied hospitals, schools, took over buildings, and were able to develop that network along the lines of a free universal daycare. Demand. And at some point, we started thinking back to that common front, 1972 common front, because we knew we didn't have the leverage to get the network that the families and the women and the children deserved. So we thought that the main demand of the 72 general strike was $100 minimum for everybody a week. And of course, $100, that's in 1972 money. That was one. In 1976 was the first, the main demand was parental leave. That was one. In 1979, it was a decent workplace insurance law, and that was one. So I put it in my head with others that the 1982 one would be the central demand would be universal daycare. But to do that, we thought we needed to be in a union. So that's when we formed the first daycare workers union. And one of the reasons for that is that even though there was lots of unity amongst the parents and the workers, there had been across Quebec 8 cases where workers had been fired. And we investigated the cases because we said, well, you know, maybe at some point the workers did something bad, but in all the 8 cases, it had been the workers that had been fired. And when we investigated them, we saw that there was some cases that were not correct. So we said the workers need also organization, but still keeping unity with the parents. And of course, we thought the trade union movement would give us the leverage needed to get that universal right, as we had won the 3 first ones. So I was put on leave, and we decided to occupy as many electoral posts, never full-timers, as we could in the workers' women's commissions. I was in the National Political Action Committee of the CSN. I co-wrote health policy with the hospital workers. I was on the strike, the mobile team, getting votes, not just in the daycares, but also in the hospitals, in the pensions places, in the community clinics. And we started that strike along the following plan. And I worked very hard on that plan. First day out, only the daycare centers. But before we went out, we went to all the daycare centers and we met with the parents, and we says we're going on, out on strike for better salaries, but for free daycare for your children. We need your help. So the way the strike is going to work is, let's say there's 12 workers in this daycare center for 40 children. We're going to leave 3 workers at the daycare, which will liberate 9 workers, and the parents will do the balance of the work themselves in collaboration for the length of the strike. So let's say, for example, in Montreal, we had 100 daycare centers unionized. On average, that would be about 15 people, workers liberated by. So that means we had 1,500 daycare workers. So on that first day of the strike, that became a 1,500 mobile team to fuck up the government everywhere we could and put us on the map, okay? When we called the strike, of course, the reporters in the papers were saying the first day of the strike is only the daycare centers because that's the central demand. The second day of the strike would be the community clinics because that there's less problems with public opinion with that. And the last, and so on, and then the teachers, and then the college teachers, and then the elementary teachers, and then the university teachers. And the last day of the strike, which daycare was Monday, the last group to go out would be the next Monday after the weekend, and that would be the general hospitals, because that's an iffy one. It has more problems. But before that, on the Saturday, we'd have a national demonstration in Quebec City, where all the union would go under one banner, and the main banner in front would be universal daycare. And when we got there, the bureaucrats tried to tell me, no, your banner is not going to be in front. And I says, we've got not just thousands of workers from all over Quebec, we brought thousands and thousands of our parents with us. And no, that banner is going to be in front. And I actually had to throw a few punches in the face of a bureaucrat to get that banner in front, but it was in front. And for some reason, I'd been going around all Quebec organizing. For some reason, the turnout from my hometown had been magnificent. 9 buses, 600 miles, one way, 600 miles the other way, of parents and workers from my hometown of 30,000. So for some reason, I said, I need to go back with my people back to my hometown. So even if I was tired, I hopped off, and that was in the middle of winter, I hopped on the bus. And back then, we didn't have the internet. We had telegrams or phones, not cell phones. And for some reason, even though I was dead, I decided to stop off at the union office in Noranda. And when I got there, we had received the telegram during the night. That was on a Sunday morning after that demonstration of 40,000 in Quebec City. And the telegram said, we've got an agreement. The strike is suspended. Tuesday morning, 36 hours later, everybody meets, all the delegates meet in Quebec City so that the CSN Congress can decide to accept the agreement. So I call up all the unionized workers that I know, plus, of course, some of my political comrades, and I tell them what the situation is, and they say, well, what do you think, Richard? How do we stop? We know how we start a strike, but how do we stop one in the CSN? Well, I says, I don't know. Let's look up the Constitution. I never had looked at because there was the Constitution when you join, but there's a separate Constitution that rules when you're on strike because you're using union funds. And so I looked it up, and it said there, the only instance, a level that can stop a public sector strike is the Congress of Delegates. So I said, the telegram is legal. We're going to follow the Constitution of the CSN, and we're going to stay on fucking strike until we meet with our comrades Tuesday morning. So Tuesday morning, the whole CSN goes back to work. The whole QFL goes back to work. But the teachers decide to stay out. They're not in the same union as us. So that day in the papers was the CSN is back to work, the QFL is back to work, the teachers are out, and for some reason this small daycare union in northern Quebec. So Tuesday morning, when I got there, there was 2,000 people in the hall. Everybody was going crazy. All the full-timers were there. And the president of my federation was a guy from my region that had asked me to sign when he presented his candidacy, when he had presented his candidacy 2 years before, and I had signed it because I trusted him. And he opens up the deliberations, but by that time in the hallways, all the delegates came to see me and they said, Richard, you're the only one that has the legitimacy to speak here because you're the only delegate here that has followed the constitution of our union. So as I went up and I confronted my president that I had supported his candidacy, the only signature he had. And I said, Eve, what happened? And of course, I preceded this with an intervention. And all hell broke loose in the hall. And he took his hammer, a gavel, and said, point of order, we're stopping deliberations for half an hour. People have to call down. And then he rushed running down the tribune into the hallway towards the elevators. And I ran after him. I caught him by the shoulders and I smashed him on the wall and I said, you're going to tell me what happened. He says, okay, I'll tell you, Richard. This is what I have to write for Monday. But if ever you say it, I'll deny it. He says, when the 40,000 people left for the different regions, we were having the four public sector federation presidents. We were having a beer at the Perroquet, which is a bar close to the National Assembly. And we were pretty proud of all the work we had done. And at some point, a full-timer comes in, exhausted, and he says, run up to the National Assembly right now, up the hill. The president of the CSN, Denis Saint-Corriveau, who nobody remembers because he was kicked out in an internal putsch a couple of months after, the official communique was he had a heart attack. Okay, he never had this heart attack. He was pushed out for treason. Denis Saint says he's with Monsieur Lévesque and the national negotiator, which is Lucien Bouchard, which was also later Prime Minister of Quebec, all nationalists, okay, so-called social democrats. We got an agreement. So you have to go there right now. So we thought, Jesus Christ, this strike is a bit easier than the three preceding ones, you know. We won. And we got that universal daycare, first time in the world. So we run up to the National Assembly, and in the hallway, the cops say, go there in this hallway, and we see the president of the CSN in the hallway, and there's this door in front of him. And he says, come on in. And we thought we were going into an office where we'd be alone with him, and there would be the public sector conventions there. An agreement of 210 or 300,000 workers of all kinds of different categories, professions, skills, etc., is like a huge table with 3 feet high of documents you have to go through. There was a single, we go in, on. There's a table with a single document on it. And in front of the table, there's the Prime Minister of Quebec, what you call it, the English called Premier of Quebec, and the future Premier of Quebec, which is the boss's negotiator, Lucien Bouchard. And the president of the union says, look, and he signs an agreement in front of the four presidents who know nothing. They actually represent like 170,000 workers. They know nothing of it. They just witnessed the signing. And he says, this is the agreement. Every worker in the public sector for the next 6 months gets nothing, no indexation, no raise, but loses 20% of his weekly wage. And the daycare movement gets 50 cents a day by child. It's a victory. This is what happened. This has never been written anywhere. But like I said, when Errol write it, he'll deny it. On my mother's grave.
So listening to your personal experience with the movement, From the United States perspective, a lot of this will sound foreign to militants and revolutionaries. What did those transitions look like coming from a period when there was the nationalist struggle, often kind of a military struggle, to more mass-based organizing, wildcats, autonomous activity of the working class in Quebec? And coming in now, we're maybe in like a third period, or I don't know how many periods we want to have, of global capitalist crisis, and we see a new wave, because you described kind of how this childcare movement was built up, and alongside that there were housing movements, there was workers' movements, educational movements that all made various gains through that period. How did those transitions happen, and what do you think the impact was of those gains on the Quebec working class and how it's influencing struggles today?
Okay, so 1972 was probably the high point. Okay, we didn't know it yet. There was still lots of industrial strikes and other social movements, the women's movement, gay rights, etc., through the 70s, beginning of the 80s. But they gradually diminished because of the impact of the crisis. Steel plants closing down, runaway shops, that's how we used to call them back then, runaway shops to Mexico. That was the place where they went back then. It's Asia now. They're all always looking for what they call the level playing field, as if it was a game. And that doesn't exist under capitalism. It started to wear down, and there were less and less strikes. And that actually had a huge impact on the radical left in Quebec. There were almost no anarchists in Quebec, to be frank. There were some, maybe 100 people would gather under a black banner on May Day. They were certainly not called themselves anarcho-communists. It was the Maoists and Trotskyists that dominated the scene back then. And the left social democrats, of course. On May Day 1977, La Presse reported that out of a May Day demonstration of 25,000, workers in Montreal, and by the way, we had May Day demonstrations in the regional cities too, so that was not a national demonstration, it was a local demonstration. 9,000 were marching under the red banners, especially of the two main Maoist organizations, ML, En Lutte, In Struggle Mine, and the official pro-Chinese operation, which was called the Workers' Communist Party. And that was not all we had, because if we had workers from factories there, we'd tell them to go and march with their factory banner. So that means we were much more. But what happened is the working class resistance movement dropped down, contrary to everything we had expected. And at the same time, especially for the Marxist-Leninist, anti-Soviet radicals, there was a huge crisis. China exploded. We learned a lot of stuff on what we didn't know about the Cultural Revolution. There was a war between our two brother parties when China tried to invade Vietnam, when the Americans left and the Vietnamese beat the shit out of them. We learned about Cambodia. We started to question the 60% 40 positive, 40% negative that Mao Tse-tung had said about Stalin, okay? And in Quebec especially, which like a few other countries like Norway, Spain, Portugal, Greece, where the movement had actually been a mass, almost mass movement, there was a worldwide collapse of Marxism-Leninism, okay? The anti-revisionist one of the RCP, Communist Worker Party, Freedom Road, socialist organization, Variety. And this was linked also probably to a crisis in the personal life of many of those people that all happened to be coming to age 30 rather than 20, having a family rather than being single, having more problems finding jobs than 10 years before, etc., etc., etc. And the 80s were pretty bad, really shitty. And those organizations disappeared at a time when the crisis really started to hit, okay? And For example, the nationalists of the Parti Québécois, Social Democrats, continued hurting people after that 20% cut. For example, in the mid-80s, I think it was 84, it was the International Year of Youth declared by United Nations or UNESCO. And the government decided that year of mass youth unemployment that if you were on welfare and you had you were 30 years or older, I think the exact number was $465 a month to live on welfare. But if you were less than 30 years old, you got $165 on welfare a month. And that created in the 80s the only movement of resistance of some effect, which was called Regroupement Autonome des Jeunes. That year, I turned 30. So I decided I would help them, but I would never be a member. But you can see some photos of occupations, mass occupations, but also fantastically imaginative ones in my home later on or another voyage. And we were able to beat back the government. The last one probably being the last one I organized in Rouyn-Noranda, which was the occupation of a frozen lake in front of that huge factory on the most polluted lake one of the most polluted lakes in North America, in front of the third most polluting factory in North America that year, and was called Operation Under 30, because it actually was under 30 degrees Fahrenheit when he did it for 3 weeks in tents, and it was also for the people under 30, and it got mass coverage across Canada, and it got mass coverage from the local workers, and youth came to my little hometown, well, at that time of Rouyn-Noranda, in buses from Quebec City and Montreal and everywhere. And to the point where four ministers came into one of that tent by special plane to try and negotiate the end of injustice. And we told them, we don't negotiate the end of injustice. We ceased injustice. And that was wrong.
So in talking to you previously, just for a little bit, I know that even now you're still very involved with the student movement that's going on right now. So I wanted to ask you, since you've seen various waves of struggles and different movements over the years, how do you see this current student strike different, if it is, from other previous struggles, or where do you think it's going?
I this is a 60% answer because I'm not sure yet, okay, because history is being done. But it is history that's being done, okay? Many workers' historians say that 1972 general strike in Quebec was probably the biggest event in working class history in Canada and United States, probably not in Mexico. So in a great part of North America. And I was part of that. I started with that. But... And that was a workers' movement. And as a worker, I tried to struggle against my workerism, okay? And as an older man, I tried to struggle against some prejudice that we all have sometimes against the younger generations. And it's a real preoccupation. But I must say that the general strike of 72 was a very short-term one, even if it was the more classical workers coming out. But today's students are all future workers. The new technologies, the new ways of production mean that you need to go to school longer. And the capitalists admit that themselves. So it's time us workers from my generation accept that this is a real struggle. It's part of the class struggle. And it's a much more sustained in time struggle. It's the 13th week from the beginning of the first strikes. And almost every week since then, I've been saying to the younger guys and girls, comrades, this is the week. And it's never the week because the strike keeps going on and on and on despite all the treason from the labor bureaucrats, the despicable practice of the bourgeois press that it's proving that it is an ideological tool of the state. And of course, the repression of the police that is on a scale that's. One of my Toronto comrades says, unprecedented, I think is the word. It's a beautiful movement, it's an important movement, and it's a sign of the times and a sign of things to come. Ça va tu?
Merci.
Thank you for listening to our program today. Be sure to check back for more content at miamiautonomyandsolidarity.wordpress.com, recomposition.info for more articles, interviews, audio recordings, and artwork.
Creates this alienation. The capitalist mode of production creates